This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. We put the spotlight on peacemakers throughout history and today. Whether it's the search for inner peace or learning how to resolve conflicts we have with others in our families, workplaces, communities, or between nations, we consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and for over 30 years, our guest today has been studying conflict resolution and applying all he's learned to all of those circles. William Urey co-founded Harvard's program on negotiation, and he served as a negotiation advisor and mediator in conflicts ranging from corporate mergers to wildcat strikes in a Kentucky coal mine, to ethnic wars in the Middle East, the Balkans, and the former Soviet Union. William Urey is the author of books like Why We Fight, Getting Past No, Negotiating with Difficult People, and co-author of Getting to Yes, Negotiating Agreement Without Giving In, an 8 million copy bestseller translated into over 30 languages. His book, Getting to Peace, has been re-released in paperback under the title The Third Side. Our host, Suzanne Kreider, spoke recently with William Urey.
How did you come up with this term, third side, and how would you define it?
Yeah, what I noticed, Suzanne, is that we always tend to see conflict as two-sided. We always, you know, it's the Arabs versus the Israelis, it's union versus management, it's husband versus wife, it's one child versus another child. But in reality, there's always a third side, which is the people around the parties, the community, the friends, the allies, the bystanders, the siblings. And that larger community constitutes what I call the third side. And that is actually the key to helping to prevent, resolve, and contain conflict. The third side is the surrounding community that stands up for a peaceful transformation of the conflict. In other words, the third side is us.
You've spent time with the Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert. What did you learn about peacemaking from them?
Well, the San, the Bushmen, live... They're really one of the last groups of hunter-gatherers living on the planet. And hunter-gathering was a form of life that we humans had for over 99% of our time on Earth. And so they live in small communities of about 500, networks of 500, usually in small groups of around 25 or 30 at any one time. And they have conflicts, and they all actually have also... For their hunting, they use poison arrows that are tipped, and so each man who's hunting actually has the equivalent of what we might consider to be a nuclear bomb, because the poison is absolutely fatal. If it enters someone's blood, they die within 2 days, and so they're all walking around with these weapons that can kill a human being, and at that scale of a society, you kill one or two or three people, it's a huge catastrophe. And so I was really curious, how do they deal with their disputes? How do they deal when emotions get high and they have jealousies and they have conflicts? And what I learned from them is they have a very sophisticated system where everyone in the community kind of pays attention. And when emotions start to go high, they notice conflict starting to escalate, someone goes and hides the poison arrows out in the middle of the desert. And then the whole group gathers together in a circle, and they sit around, and they talk, and they listen. And they may talk and listen for a day, for 2 days, for 3 days, for however long it takes. At night, they dance, and they try to kind of invoke the spirits to give them guidance. And they don't rest until they, you know, resolve the conflict. And it's not enough just to kind of reach a resolution, but they need to have a reconciliation between the parties who are in conflict. And so has to be some forgiveness. And if people aren't ready for that, then they have a system where someone goes and visits their relatives over in another water hole for a few months. And they have a whole complicated, very sophisticated system for catching conflict before it escalates, for resolving it, and for containing it if it threatens to escalate. And it's been very successful. And to me, it's that kind of system that probably explains why we human beings are still alive today.
So this complicated system involves these three pieces. They catch it, they resolve it, and somehow they contain it. What are some ways that they can catch it more quickly?
They pay attention. They pay attention to, it's the friends, the neighbors, the relatives. I mean, every conflict, no conflict ever comes right out of the blue. Every conflict has early warning signals. People get upset. They get angry. They take it out. They talk to their friends. And so they pay attention to those early signals, and they make sure that, that things get talked out and that it gets the attention that it needs, that, that people's needs, which are often being somehow dissatisfied, get addressed in time before the conflict gets out of control.
And in your book, The Third Side, you talk about these three levels of peacemaking. Talk about the roles that are under prevention. So there's the provider, the teacher, and the bridge builder. Let's use, for example, like in a school, if we wanted to get a better handle on bullying.
Yeah, the provider plays the role of addressing the basic needs, which like needs for security, needs for attention, needs for recognition. And oftentimes you find that bullying, what motivates a bully? What motivates a bully is usually insecurity, is a kind of a feeling of not getting attention, of not being acknowledged, of not having power, of not having control, which are all basic human needs, but are more highly accentuated in people who are given to bullying behavior. And so, one, you can try and make sure that, that the students in the classroom do get the attention that they need, because bullying is a kind of way of kind of reaching out in that sense in a destructive way. But the other thing you do is you make sure that everyone in the class gets respect, and that you establish in the beginning. The teachers who are most successful, I find, are the ones who establish from the very beginning that they don't tolerate disrespect in the classroom, either towards the teacher or between students. The key to reversing bullying is for the community, for the other students, for teachers to pay attention, to watch what's going on, to look for those signals, and to catch it before it escalates into abusive behavior.
And so the teacher's going to be instructing them on how to prevent conflict, I'm
right.
assuming.
That's
part of bullying program.
And that's another role of prevention, which is the teacher. I mean, is actually helping the children learn how to deal with conflict in constructive ways. And so schools, a lot of schools, for example, have these programs, of conflict resolution programs, where they help children learn these skills. And children are even trained to be peer mediators and to try to catch the conflicts, and the children themselves learn to resolve them among themselves, which, of course, is best of all.
Well, I don't want to be a downer, but why can't we prevent school violence?
Well, I think we can, and I think we can. I mean, it's a good question of why we haven't thus far, but we're definitely capable of it. I mean, it's not just something that, you know, we can say in the future. You can actually see examples where schools have turned this around, where situations. I remember I used to live in Boston, and Boston had in the 90s, in the 1990s, had a spate of youth murders, homicides. I mean, just dozens and dozens. And then at some point, the community, the third side, got together and said, enough is enough. And it was initially led by a group of ministers called the 10-Point Coalition. They involved the parents. They involved the teachers. They involved the police. They got everyone collaborating, working together, because every one of those people, every one of those constituencies had information or had abilities to play a kind of a third side role. And particularly worked with the youth and actually looked at, you know, why are the youth engaging in this kind of behavior? For example, they had nothing to do, for example, on after school. So they started organizing basketball programs after school, even midnight basketball, for instance. Or the young people had no self-esteem. So they began to offer, you know, jobs to the youth so that they could develop their self-esteem, those kinds of things. And it was not any single magic bullet, but it was all of those things put together and everyone working together that made it work.
Yeah. Who are some other famous third siders who people would know and recognize?
Well, I think all of us, actually, each of us is a third sider. But, you know, some famous third siders, I mean, Mahatma Gandhi, for example, was a third sider. A third sider is basically someone who basically takes the third side, because we always see conflict. If you think about it, just the way our minds are organized, we see conflict always as two-sided. And the third side realizes, wait a minute, I don't have to take one side. I don't have to take the other side. I can take the third side, which is the side of the whole, and stand for the peaceful transformation of the conflict to the benefit of the parties and the benefit of the larger community. And that's what a third-sider does. And if you think about it, this is our oldest human heritage that's right there in front of us. Every culture has its own methods for kind of mobilizing the community. And right now, in our society, we need to continually reinvent the third side. We need to reinvent it in a society that's highly, you know, individualistic, in a society where right now a lot of our communication is through the internet. And right now in the world, we have to invent a kind of a global third side that's capable of stopping, preventing, catching wars before they even start. Genocide, for example. Any genocide is preventable. Like Rwanda, for example. You know, that terrible genocide in Rwanda where over 500,000 people died. I mean, it was clear that it was a failure. It was a failure of the larger community to pay attention. Everyone agrees now that even there was a UN general who was there on the ground. Even at that last moment, he said, look, even with 2 weeks into the beginning of the genocide, the beginning of the killing, he had 1,000 or 2,000 UN troops there. He said if we had had 5,000 troops, if they just brought in 5,000 troops, then that would have been, you know, something easy to do. He plotted out how he could have stopped the genocide right there. And of course, it could have been caught even before because there were early warning signals to this.
Which of the roles was he playing? Was he the peacekeeper or the referee?
He was trying to be the peacekeeper. And he had very strict instructions, unfortunately, that because he actually could see on the ground, and they were sending reports months before the genocide began. The genocide wasn't, as it was often portrayed, just some kind of spark, the irrational outburst of hatred. It was carefully organized and orchestrated by a group of people associated with the government. They were starting to make lists of the people that they were going to kill. They were starting to take control of the radio and the media systems and so on. So it was a carefully orchestrated plot, and that was known to people. And there were a lot of people in the larger community, in the world community, who had the ability to stop it.
But that's the frustration. I don't understand what we do then when the UN general is saying, give me 5,000 more people, and the UN doesn't listen. What's the solution?
Well, the solution is to learn. I mean, in this particular case, our country played a very unfortunate role. President Clinton, this is maybe, he expresses this, his greatest regret of the years that he was in office, because there'd been a tragedy in Somalia with our troops there that was portrayed in that movie, Black Hawk Down. And so the American people were very kind of reluctant to get involved in any kind of mess. And so as a result, when the call came from the UN general to the UN system, the United States said, no, we can't get involved in this. It was like there was a willful denial at that point. But now that we've seen what happened and it's been analyzed, people are much more sensitive to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And so each time there's a lesson. I mean, the lesson was learned the very hard way in that particular case. But I think people learned the lesson. People like President Clinton, for example, and the UN Secretary General at the time was Kofi Annan. He certainly learned the lesson. And I think people have responded differently, for example, to the killings that happened in Sudan as a result of what happened in Rwanda. And so very slowly, torturously, even, you know, two steps forward, one steps back, humanity is basically learning that these things aren't like, they're not like hurricanes, they're not like forces of nature. These wars and conflicts are products of human behavior and can be prevented by human behavior.
Dr. Bill Urey, let's explain a little bit more about the third side model to our listeners. The resolve step, the second step, has four different roles. And let's use the workplace because most of our listeners go to work or they've had jobs in the past. Talk about one or two of the resolve roles and how people can use those in the workplace to prevent conflict.
One of the roles is the role of the mediator, and everyone in the workplace, you don't have to be a professional mediator, but everyone in the workplace is a third party. They hear, they see two people or two departments get into a conflict, and there are informal ways in which we can play the role of a mediator, which is to listen to each side, to hear them out, to try and communicate each to the other what the other one is saying, to bring them together, to encourage them to work it out. We can play that role of a mediator. And every manager, you know, whether they think about it or not, for example, is a mediator of sorts. They have to mediate among their staff. They have to mediate among their bosses sometimes. They have to mediate among their colleagues. Everyone, in fact, in the workplace can play that role of a third sider. But one of the roles also is the role of the healer, which is that there's an emotional dimension to a lot of conflicts. Human beings, we all have emotions, and so oftentimes those feelings, the relationship needs to be healed. It's not just enough to resolve the conflict, as you know, the Bushmen teach us. You have to bring the people back into a relationship so that they can continue to work together, because after all, that's what you're doing in the workplace.
Do you see the possibility that workplaces might even want to talk more openly about third side roles, or are there a lot of mediation programs already in workplaces?
Well, it's beginning. There's been a huge shift in the last 30 years that I've been involved and watching. Nowadays, I mean, for example, labor management conflicts 100 years ago, there used to be a lot of violence in that. Even when I worked in labor management in the coal mines back in the 70s, there were bomb threats and people were packing guns. Nowadays, people are learning to talk things out. They're learning, okay, we can negotiate. There are negotiation courses. There are mediators involved. There's been a lot more sophistication now in the workplace about how to deal with differences, and the work has just begun. We have a ways to go, but I do see a lot of progress in the last generation.
Let's talk briefly though about the third stage, which mm-hmm. is containment. Mm-hmm. And Bill, I'm going to a family reunion this weekend, and I'm not expecting any fisticuffs. However, in the past, you know, there's been some door slamming and some yelling. So what are one or two of the containment roles that my siblings could play just in case somebody kind of blows it?
Yeah, well, a containment role might be that if things start to escalate out of control, you know, someone just separates the two parties and say, hey, you know what, or takes one of the siblings for a walk and just kind of just a little bit of a cooling off period. You know, a family is a really good instance, because if you think about a healthy family and you look at what the parents do, they're playing all 10 roles seamlessly. They don't think about it necessarily, but they're playing the role of the provider. They're giving the kids the love, the attention that they need. They're playing the role of the teacher, helping the kids learn to talk things out. They're playing the role of the mediator sometimes. They're playing the role of the arbiter. And they're playing the containment roles of, hey, you know, being the witness, kind of watching what's going on. And then if things start to escalate, saying, hey, look, no fists, you know, you can use pillows. Or sometimes playing the role of the peacekeeper, of separating the kids. So if you think about it all the time, these are roles. It's not something I've invented. This is just something I'm naming that is really around us all the time. It's our human heritage, and it's just something that we need to bring out to elaborate and to reinvent to deal with the conflicts and the violence of today.
So Bill Ury, thirdside.org says, and I quote, "You can have natural sympathies for one side or the other, and still choose to take the third side." Isn't that really hard to do? Isn't that going against human nature?
Well, I don't think so, actually. In fact, because, I mean, that's exactly what, you know, the Bushmen do in the Kalahari and the Semi. I mean, what they learn is that you can be someone's friend, for example, and sympathize, you can be for them. At the same time, you're, you know, like Nelson Mandela is another example. I mean, someone who was definitely on one side of the conflict in South Africa. But he was very clear all throughout, as he makes very clear in his speeches, his autobiography, that he was fighting for the freedom not just of blacks but of whites as well. He was fighting for the whole.
Doesn't that take a pretty evolved consciousness, though?
Don't get me wrong. It's not easy. I mean, the third side's simple. It's a simple concept because it's around, but it's not easy. And dealing with our differences is some of the hardest work that we human beings have to do in our lives. You know, really dealing with our differences, handling our emotions, learning to forgive the other side, listening to things we don't want to hear. It's some of the hardest work, the hardest challenges that we face. But this is something that has been around since time immemorial, and it's something that is available to each one of us at whatever level of awareness we're at.
If you could give our listeners a pep talk, just three short, simple things, what would they be?
Well, to realize it's the peace is in your hands. It's not. It's something that you can do. It's not something far off. It's possible because it takes place in daily life, and just to kind of open our eyes to that. So that would be one. And a second thing is to learn to. I use the phrase sometimes to go to the balcony, which is to learn to kind of detach ourselves a little bit, to like go to a mental and emotional balcony, a place of calm. We all have our ways of doing that, whether it's to go for a walk, if we get upset or we're in a moment of high emotion, or it might be to breathe, or it might be to talk to a friend, or it might be to go work out. But learn to keep on going to the balcony where we can keep our eyes on the prize and remember what's truly important for us and for the community in that regard. That ability to separate for a moment and then to come back with a new perspective of what's needed and what do you really want and what do the parties really want. And then the third thing would be to look behind the positions, in other words, the things that people say they want, that they're insisting on. For what do they really want? Using the magical question, why? Why do you want that? Because oftentimes you can't reconcile the positions because one person wants to take their vacation in the mountains and one person wants to take their vacation by the sea. But then you say, wait a minute, what is it you really want? You find out what are the underlying interests and says, well, I really want to have good time with you. I want to experience have fresh air and so on. Then you can be creative and come up with a solution that might work for both sides. You might be able to find a place that there's mountains by the sea. So the idea is to always probe behind positions. Don't just take positions for granted at face value, but look behind them for what are the real underlying needs and see if you can come up with solutions that meet both sides' needs and the need of the larger community, which is the third side.
Dr. William Urey, author of the book The Third Side and many other books on conflict resolution. Urey's had a great impact on the negotiation and mediation world. We'll continue now by talking to a couple of people who've trained with William Urey and have gone on to apply the skills of the third side to their work. First, Dana Smith, the co-founder and executive director of Dogwood Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending forests in the southern U.S. from industrial misuse. The Dogwood Alliance has had some success convincing office supply chains from making paper from endangered forests, striking a deal with the Staples chain to reduce its footprint in those forests. She told Suzanne Kreider what she'd learned from Bill Urey that helped her in her negotiations with Staples.
One of the most valuable lessons I learned is not to get stuck in my own position. We all have positions in a view of the world and the way that we see it. And it's really, really important in negotiations to be willing to step out of your box and look for paths forward that you may not have thought about as a solution.
What were some of the hardest times in those meetings where it was really difficult to listen, and how did you break through?
Our last meeting with Staples, I think, was probably the most tense. And I remember we had to take a break. We had to each just sort of take a time out and regroup, take a breath, and come back with a fresh new attitude. And I think that really, really helped everyone to realize where we needed to go and if we were going to reach agreement.
Dana, Bill Urey talks about the third side. Who do you think was the third side in these negotiations?
I think both parties brought a little bit of the third side to it. I think both Staples and Dogwood Alliance sort of met each other at the third side.
To summarize, what would you say to our listeners who might be involved in some kind of negotiation or third side process are the three key things to remember?
One, make sure that you're addressing issues related to the imbalance of power. It's very, very important to go into negotiations from a place of strength. The second thing is that it's equally as important not to get frustrated personally with the people that you're negotiating with, and to really work hard to build personal relationships, find areas of common interest, and talk about those outside of the issues. And the third thing, I think, is to remember to step out of your box and to really look to find solutions that work for both parties as much as possible that don't compromise your core interests.
Dana Smith of the Dogwood Alliance. And now on a line from Venezuela, Gachi Tapia, a lawyer and mediator who's worked in conflict zones in Latin America. She was part of a team that included Jimmy Carter and William Ury that many believe prevented a civil war in Venezuela by monitoring elections and mediating conflicts between principal players in 2004. Ms. Tapia was involved with many of the higher-level meetings and told Suzanne how she applied third-side principles.
I was doing this through some role plays with him and through some very deep conflict analysis, through trying to put what we call to put the people in the shoes of the opponent and try to really be very clear in terms of separating the persons from the problems, which are always confused. And they commonly believe is that the problem is the person, which does not help solve it, you know, mainly helps perpetuating it.
So, Gachi, what could you tell our listeners to do when they're in a situation? It's certainly not as complex as the one you were in Venezuela. But what are some specific things that you did or you said that helped people understand what it's like to be in the other person's shoes?
Well, one of the things that I think is the most useful is to really be an observer of our own thoughts. We are usually and consciously driven by this idea of putting others negative connotations, attributing bad intentions, without confirming they are so. It's about working a lot with ourselves, not only with the others.
Gachi Tapia, what are one or two tips you can give to our listeners for how to use the third side to make peace?
Well, I think a very simple tool is to listen. But to listen, not to respond, but to listen just to really understand the other one. This is something you can do every day. It's a day-to-day work. And it's not about very, very complex systems. It's about the very little systems in which you are moving. It's about home. It's about your community. It's about your work. And the quality of connection with the people starts by recognizing the other one, listening, and respecting them. When you are really, truly respecting others, this a quality of connection that starts moving on, and that makes a difference.
Conflict management expert Gachi Tapia talking with Suzanne Kreider about one of her many successful involvements in international conflict resolution, the 2004 Venezuelan elections. To find useful links and to hear complete interviews with all our guests, and soon to hear an hour-long version of this program, visit our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear all the programs in our series dating back to 2003. You can also order CDs, sign up for a free podcast and monthly newsletter, and importantly, find out how you can keep this particular program on the air by making a tax-deductible contribution to the nonprofit media organization that produces the show, Good Radio Shows Incorporated. Your dollars really do make a difference. Find out more about doing your part at peacetalksradio.com. Additional support comes from the Oppenheimer Brothers Foundation, AMP Concerts, Albuquerque's roving concert series at ampconcerts.org, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Ali Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For Suzanne Kreider, I'm Paul Ingles. Thanks for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.